date, which because of last year has taken on added significance to each of us personally in the history of the court. And last year, the court continued its business on September 11. Nothing was as usual. And today we sit also, but we mark the first anniversary of the tragic violent events of September 11, 2001. And among the many ceremonies planned around our state is a remembrance here at the Capitol at noon. Events of September 11, 2001 changed our lives in infinite ways. Many of us now wear identification tags every day. We look out upon the Capitol grounds and see concrete barricades blocking entrances. We have grown accustomed to opening bags for inspection and to returning mail that doesn't look quite right. We are more cognizant than ever of the value of peaceful resolution of disputes according to the law. We are aware, perhaps like never before, of what the philosopher Hannah Arendt called the living space of freedom, the space between people that is guarded by the law. To be truly free, we need protections from tyrants and bullies, and sometimes from each other. Freedom is a precious and fragile gift. It requires care. Our independent courts provide that care, safeguarding our freedoms by deciding cases on the basis of the facts and law, independent of pressure from outside influences. An independent judicial system that dispenses justice fairly, impartially, and according to the rule of law is the cornerstone of our democracy. And so, on this anniversary, we give thanks for our many freedoms. We grieve for the men and women who lost their lives on September 11 and in its aftermath. We keep them and their families in our hearts. We salute the men and women who have left their families and homes to defend those freedoms. We salute the men and women who remain in Wisconsin at their posts to preserve the rule of law and provide every person with equal protection under the law. And in keeping with remaining at our posts today, I'll call the first case. The first case is 01-2787. In re the termination of parental rights to Thomas J.R. And we have our guardian ad litem, Daniel P. And is it Bestel?
Bestel, yes.
And then we have Dwayne Jorgensen representing Robert T.R. And then you have a rebuttal. Counsel, you may begin.
Thank you. I am Dan Bestel. I'm the guardian ad litem for Thomas in this case. Under the ruling of the Court of Appeals, Thomas has no forum to determine whether his father is unfit. The Wisconsin legislature has declared that parents who meet certain criteria, or I should say children whose parents meet certain criteria, may come before a circuit court and ask that court to determine first whether the facts merit a finding of unfitness, and second, if the parent is unfit, whether it's in the child's best interest to terminate the parental rights and let the child move on to a new life in a new family relationship. And the legislature has even declared that Thomas, through a guardian ad litem, can ask the court to determine if, in this case, his father is unfit. But without the status doctrine as incorporated by the Wisconsin legislature in the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, Thomas has no court that he could go to determine whether his father is in fact unfit and whether Thomas's status as Robert's son should be terminated so he can move on to a new life.
Also, is that really correct? It's my understanding that the reason that the Arizona court declined jurisdiction was the child was not present in Arizona. So if the child was present in Arizona, isn't there then the possibility of Arizona being the forum?
The petition could be filed if he was present there, but then the court under the UCCJA in Arizona would have to go through the analysis as to whether that court was competent to proceed. And it is not the child's home state. There's no emergency present. The child has no significant relationship with Arizona and has not for a significant period of time. So really the only way the Arizona court could hear the case is if Thomas moved to Arizona, established a residence for a period of there, and made Arizona the home state.
Well, the child was born in Arizona, is that correct?
He was born in Arizona, yes.
And the child's father is in Arizona. And if the child himself was in Arizona, aren't those significant enough contacts then to allow Arizona to exercise jurisdiction, especially if the Wisconsin court said go ahead?
If a Wisconsin court said go ahead and an Arizona court determined those contacts were sufficient to make the court competent under the UCCJA, yes, that is correct. However, I don't believe mere presence of the child, and in fact under the UCCJA, mere presence of the child in a state is not enough to generate the contacts. The UCCJA wants maximum contacts, wants any litigation for a custody determination to be held in the state of maximum contacts.
So your position would be that if we really applied the UCCJA, that the significance would be with Wisconsin, the significant contacts that would be looked at would point toward Wisconsin rather than Arizona. Is that correct?
That's really where all of the information concerning the last 6 years of care concerning the child is, and all of the information going forward, because even as of this date, the father does not have any right to have any visitation or any contact with the child. So really, all information concerning the child's past and future care is here in Wisconsin. And if Arizona found that was an appropriate forum, the information available to the Arizona court would be minimal at best. In addition to that, if he went to Arizona, even though he's been a Wisconsin resident all these years, he would be subject to the Arizona termination statutes, which are different, frankly, than the Wisconsin statutes. And he would have to meet a different set of grounds than what the Wisconsin legislature has said he may employ here.
Thank you.
Addressing the UCCJA, the UCCJA was designed to address situations where multiple states have a claim over the child. Prior to the UCCJA, there was essentially chaos. And the commissioner's notes to the UCCJA note that, that multiple states could render custody determinations because custody determinations had not been determined under the United States Supreme Court to be entitled to full faith and credit. And so in cases like May versus Anderson, the case that came out of Wisconsin, multiple states were entering custody determinations, were entering orders, and they were being enforced largely on which parent had custody, or which parent, I should say, had possession of the child at the time. The UCCJA has been enacted by all of the states, either the UCCJA itself or its successor, the Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. And the states have adopted this as a procedure to have custody determinations made in the state, as I said, of maximum contacts, the state where the greatest amount of information is available to the child, to eliminate the chaos, to have a single court available to make these custody determinations regarding a child where contestants are in multiple states. And one of the main features of the UCCJA is that it brings in all contestants. It's intended to bring in all persons who may have a claim to the custody of the child, including, of course, parents, guardians, grandparents, the state, if the child is in the state's custody. The UCCJA, according to the commissioner's notes, is specifically drafted to take advantage of the status doctrine, that is the statement found in Pennoyer versus Neff, that every state has the authority, the jurisdiction, to determine the status of its own citizens. Article 12 of the UCCJA states that if any contestant is properly served, if they're given notice and the opportunity to be heard, the decision of the forum state under the UCCJA is binding on all contestants.
Now, you have two citizens, at least of the United States, or people in the United States. You've got the child and you got the father. So, isn't this termination determining the status of two people?
It's determining the status of the relationship between those two people, yes.
So how can you do it when you don't have the father either present or a domiciliary of the state?
Historically, that is exactly what the status doctrine has done. We've seen it most in the United States in divorce cases.
In custody or in divorce itself?
Well, historically, going back to the 19th century, it was employed in divorce cases to, I guess what it's been called today is the divisible divorce, to allow individuals to obtain a divorce in the state of their residence, even though the respondent was in some other state. And during the 1900s or 1800s and well into the 1900s, when divorce was dependent upon the domicile of the plaintiff, that was how divorces were granted. That's how divorce jurisdiction was granted. And so this is merely an extension of that same rationale to the child custody arena. It always involves the status doctrine. I shouldn't say always involves, but historically when it's been employed, it involves people in other states, because if they're both in the same states, you have minimum contacts, or you have the potential for service within the states. But historically, the status doctrine has been recognized as a valid exercise of jurisdiction to determine the status of the individuals, the relationship of the individuals, and in divorce cases, as in a custody determination, it's determining the status of the relationship between the individuals.
But hasn't just Wisconsin has historically distinguished the due process protections that are necessary in this type of act? I'm talking about a termination of parental rights, which involves the permanency, terminating the father's rights from other actions involving such as property. You're talking about divorce. So isn't this going to make it interesting if people would come to Wisconsin looking for a forum? Depending upon how this case goes, it's going to promote forum shopping to establish, all right, if you get the child here and the father can be in Taiwan or California or wherever, and therefore you've got enough now to do it.
I think the likelihood of the possibility of forum shopping is definitely there, but the possibility of forum shopping on the flip side is also there as well, that the parent who is not performing their functions as a parent can seek refuge in a state where, for example, the state's termination laws would not allow termination for the grounds of the Wisconsin would. So there's some potential for forum shopping either way, but I think in the long run, given what Wisconsin has as termination requirements, in this case, for example, a custody order that has been in place for a year that directs that a father or a parent may not have any visitation.
Right. Well, so he hasn't had any contact with his son for 9 years. So I guess that's the point that I'm talking about. So then you can, there isn't any minimal contact. There hasn't been any contact.
There hasn't been any
court order.
There hasn't been any contact. The testimony at trial indicated that early after the divorce, the father attempted to send some letters to the child, but there's been a court-imposed order that he not have any visitation.
Right.
Yes.
Mr. Bristol, one of the five factors enumerated in Asahi, as you well know, is the burden on the defendant. What burden, if any, has the defendant asserted in any proceedings in this matter?
In this case, he has not alleged that there has been any burden. He has affirmatively asserted or asked the court for relief under the UCCJA. He's asked first that he obtain a writ to allow him to come to Wisconsin while he was still in prison. Second, he asked that the petitioner, in this case the mother, bear his transportation costs. Third, and this is the one that was granted, he asked that the proceedings be delayed until he was released from the Arizona prison so he could come and participate in the proceedings here in Wisconsin. He has not presented any evidence to the court that the fact that this action has been brought in Wisconsin in any way has impaired his ability to defend in the case. He voluntarily, I don't want to say he waived the fact-finding portion of the case, but the fact-finding hearing was largely on a stipulated basis. He did waive the jury trial in that, but he appeared by telephone in those proceedings and did not object to appearing by telephone. He also appeared at the disposition hearing by telephone. So he's participated in the proceedings. The UCCJA, of course, would have given him even further rights. If he had evidence that he wanted preserved or hearings to be held, he could have had those held in Arizona. And as he asked the court, he could have asked the court to direct that transportation expenses for him to appear in Wisconsin be paid by the respondent. That's a feature that's available through the UCCJA that isn't available in most typical litigation. That's one of the things that I believe makes the UCCJA fundamentally fair in invoking the status doctrine, is some of the burdens that are imposed on a non-resident defendant can be shifted to the petitioner.
Counsel, is it your position that the status doctrine is an exception to the normal requirement of personal jurisdiction?
The normal requirement of minimum contacts?
Well, isn't minimal contacts just another form of personal jurisdiction?
Personal jurisdiction, as I understand it, is the authority of a court to bind an individual by its judgment. And certainly minimum contacts has become shorthand for personal jurisdiction in a vast number of cases. In the holdings of the United States Supreme Court, that seems to be the primary method. But
they look to 801.05, which is entitled Personal Jurisdiction, Grounds for Generally. A is a natural person present within the state. B, natural person domiciled within the state. C, domestic corporation or LLC. Or D, which is the focus of my inquiry, is engaged in substantial and not isolated activities within the state, whether such activities are wholly intrastate or otherwise. I submit, at least it's my understanding, that 801051D is nothing more than a codification of the minimum context. Is that your understanding?
I agree with that.
And that under 801051D, which is that codification, it is a grounds for personal jurisdiction.
It is a grounds for personal jurisdiction. Yeah.
But is it your I don't know, I'm asking, is it your position that the status exemption allows for personal status exemption allows for jurisdiction under the UCCJA, even though there is no personal jurisdiction?
Even though there is no personal or minimum contacts, for example, 801051A, the person present in the state, you'll note there's no requirement for analysis of the quality or nature of his contacts there. And that's the Burnham case. That's if the person is personally served within the state. That has historically been recognized as a basis for a...
Let me push you on this because I'm just not sure I'm with you. I understand we're on the same wavelength. Minimum contacts is a form of personal jurisdiction. Do you agree with that?
It's a basis for personal jurisdiction, yes.
Yes, thank you. You said it more artfully than I did. Thank you. So the question is whether or not UCCJA gives the court statutorily jurisdiction, even though there's no personal jurisdiction.
It gives the court the authority to bind the individual with regards to status alone, yes.
Okay.
I do believe it gives jurisdiction to that. You cannot tag on other jurisdiction for other issues, for example, personal obligations.
And then once you answer that, is the next question then whether or not allowing for the termination of parental rights without personal jurisdiction, that is employing the status exception to personal jurisdiction, whether or not that meets the due process requirements for the respondent. So you can do it statutorily, but that's not enough. Now I got to see if it passes constitutional muster. Is that the way you see the case, or do you see it differently? Because I'm not sure if we're talking the same way.
Clearly, the assertion of jurisdiction has to meet the requirements of due process, of both procedural due process and substantive due process. I believe the imposition or employment of the status doctrine in this case meets both of those. It meets the procedural requirements.
Notice and opportunity for hearing. Now, that's not. But it's substantive due process that's the essence of this inquiry, it seems to me.
And I think that's the criteria that Justice Bablich was referring to, the five factors under Asahi, where you look at the burden on the non-resident party. You look at the interest of the forum state, and Wisconsin clearly has a very strong interest, repeated over and over in the statutes, of protecting children from unfit parents. You look at the interest of the in-state resident in obtaining relief, and there again, you have a child. And the stated policy of this state in Chapter 48 is to protect
that
the child.
Gets me to my catch-22, and maybe I'm missing something, that those factors are factors that sound very important in weighing, but under Asahi, isn't that a minimum context case?
Asahi and the other due process, and yes, Asahi is a due process case, but all of the due process cases acknowledge that the facts in every case need to be weighed, that there are not any single there's no single rule that affords due process in every case. Due process is inherently a flexible concept. It must be afforded in every case, no question. But there is no single jurisdictional rule that affords due process to all the parties. And in this case, I would submit to my ward, Thomas, has a right to due process, to as one court had referred to it, the manifest right for redress of grievances, that Thomas has an entitlement to. And if he can do that with procedural and substantive due process in Wisconsin, the legislature has afforded a route for him to accomplish that result.
I think maybe you can read a sahi to say you need minimum contacts, and that it was a disagreement among them as to whether they met the minimum contacts. Even if you meet minimum contacts, you still have to meet the fairness test, and that it may be unreasonable to hold the defendant in that jurisdiction. And those were the five factors. That was a plurality opinion with a concurrence.
In Asahi, I believe that's correct. And Asahi, again, was a personal obligation case, which no question the minimum contacts must be met or some other procedure or constitutionally valid basis.
I follow Justice Bradley. She is, I hear her saying, you don't fit under the five prongs in the personal jurisdiction. And what you are doing, she says, or I'll say, you're adding a sixth prong from the Uniform Act. The sixth prong is status.
I think the five factors in Asahi are the factors that...
Well, is that what you're saying? Status is a sixth prong for personal jurisdiction.
That may be what she's saying. I believe that status is separate.
What do you say?
I'm saying that status has to meet those five factors of Asahi, and I think any due process basis asserted for personal jurisdiction has to meet those five factors.
Oh, okay, we can see that. And let us, at least from my reading of this, everybody went out of their way to make sure he had a full day in court if he were willing to come into Wisconsin, right? Everybody made it very easy, or tried to make it easy for him to come into Wisconsin. But he said, no, thank you. Okay, so you met the five factors. Let's just say that. You're still, the question is, are you still short on something else? If it's not one of the five in the statute, is status going to be enough? Your argument is that
I believe under Justice Scalia's opinion in Burnham, status is a doctrine that was employed at the time the 14th Amendment was ratified, and is one that was in place then and is in place today. By definition, that affords due process.
You think a custody dispute should be treated the same or different, for purposes of jurisdiction, the same or different than termination of parental rights?
This court has said that a termination case is a custody determination under the UCCJA. I think there are differences if you're dealing with a post-judgment divorce placement, and personal obligations flow along with that, and typically, for example, in Wisconsin, child support flows along with that, then you have a little bit different set of rules, but I believe custody and those personal obligations can and historically have been separated. The UCCJA was enacted because children found themselves subject to litigation in multiple states, and neither the parents nor the courts could predict which state would honor the decisions of another state. Each state in the union has adopted the UCCJA, or its cousin, to bring some order to this chaos for the benefit of the children. And Wisconsin operates under the UCCJA. It was drafted and adopted with the intent of invoking the status doctrine so custody determinations could be made in the most appropriate forum without resorting to fact-specific litigation over minimum contacts. The decision of the Court of Appeals, I believe, turns back the clock a quarter century and brings back the chaos that the UCCJA was meant to eliminate. So I urge this court, on behalf of Thomas and other children, to enforce the UCCJA as it was adopted and as it was intended to be employed, to hold that it's a valid invocation of the status doctrine, and that Wisconsin can and did properly make a custody determination that is binding on Robert, regardless of the nature of his contacts with the state.
You know, Counsel, have you had an opportunity to review the brief of the state in the Utah case that was submitted to us?
Yes, I have.
The first argument presented by the state in the Utah brief, and it's brief in chief, is neither Utah, more importantly, nor federal due process requires personal jurisdiction over a non-resident parent through minimum contacts in order to terminate his or her legal relationship to a Utah child. If you would put Wisconsin rather than Utah in that first argument heading, is that your position with regard to Wisconsin?
Yes, with emphasis on the phrase through minimum contacts.
And what do you mean by that?
That personal jurisdiction in a custody case is not acquired through the minimum contacts analysis, but through the status doctrine alone.
Now, is it possible in one of these cases that if the court should rule against you, that no state will have jurisdiction?
That's what the amicus argued, and that's certainly possible, that there would be no state. I don't know at this day where the father is, if he is still in Arizona or if he is in some other state where Thomas has no contacts whatsoever. And that's why I say that Thomas is left without a forum, because I cannot stand here and say that there is a state that would have in personam jurisdiction, if that's required, through minimum contacts and competency under the UCCJA. Wisconsin, I believe, has both of those, or has personal jurisdiction through the status doctrine, and is clearly the home state under the UCCJA.
For those of us from the old school, it sounds to me like you're arguing in rem jurisdiction.
That's been rejected as a label, but that was employed for quite a while on status doctrine cases. It's very similar.
A new name for it? Is that what you're doing?
Well, so far no one has developed a singular name for it beyond status. But yes, it's similar to in rem jurisdiction, but it's dealing not with personal obligations, but it's dealing with this relationship between the parties that's being adjudicated.
When you look at 822.03, the jurisdiction, are you relying on A, B, C, or D?
A, as the home state of the child.
Anything else?
Arguably, it could be B as well, and as a last resort. D is always a last resort. And I see my time is up. If you'd like me to answer the question, I'll complete it. The way the UCCJA is intended to operate is you work sequentially through the statute, and you determine if status or if you're competent under A. If you're competent under A, you don't need to look any farther. If not there, you can look under B. Under that approach, multiple states may be competent, or only one state may be competent to exercise jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Jorgensen, representing Robert T.R.
Thank you. May it please the court, Dwayne Jorgensen, appearing on behalf of Robert R. in support of the decision of the Court of Appeals. in this matter. And my client and I urge this court to sustain the decision of that court. The Court of Appeals properly held, in our view, that before the court may terminate forever the rights of a parent, there must be a basis not only for subject matter jurisdiction, but also for personal jurisdiction over the parent. That the uniform jurisdiction, the UCCJA, establishes subject matter jurisdiction only, but that it does not by itself establish personal jurisdiction over a non-resident parent. For there to be personal jurisdiction over a non-resident parent, that parent must have taken some action to avail himself to the benefits and services of this state.
Counsel, have you also had an opportunity to review the brief which I referred to from Utah, that is the state's brief?
I'm sorry, I really have not had a substantial opportunity to review it. I received it in the mail yesterday, and my schedule didn't allow me much time other than to briefly scan it. My impression was that the arguments made in the Utah case in many respects mirrored the same arguments that were being made in this case. I saw many of the same cases.
That's right. And actually my question to you is going to focus on one of those cases. So I don't think that there's an impediment if you've not had an opportunity to read it, because we're focusing on the same cases. And the case that I want to focus on is the case of A.E.H., which is also referred to as the case of P.C. So it's referred to both ways. An opinion of our court written by former Chief Justice Day. And the interpretation given to that case, I'm referring to page 23 of the state's brief in the Utah case, but I'll just employ that in my question. Do you agree that the interpretation of AEH is that this court concluded that a termination proceeding is a child custody proceeding under the UCCJA? Do you believe that AEH stands for that premise?
I agree with the proposition that termination of parental rights case is a custody proceeding.
And then the next sentence that I'm reading, I want to ask if you agree with that. Referring to the Schaefer case, the AEH case said, referring to the Schaefer status exception footnote, the AEH court held that personal jurisdiction over the child, not over the parent, was necessary since the UCCJA provided particularized jurisdictional rules as Schaefer contemplated. Do you agree with that interpretation of AEH? That is, that the AEH court held that personal jurisdiction over the child, not the parent, was necessary?
Well, I think I don't necessarily agree with that characterization of the case, because in AEH, you had a particularly unique situation. At the time that the first custody determination was adjudicated, the mother was dead, and the father, and there was no adjudicated father. The California court had taken a dependency-type jurisdiction over the parent. The aunt and uncle from Wisconsin had appeared, presented themselves to that court, and the court there simply turned over the child to the aunt and uncle. They traveled then back to Wisconsin, and
and establish, I believe, a either a custody or a guardianship proceeding here in this state. And then after having done that, the father in that case appeared and made a claim as far as parentage. And frankly, there's another significant difference that other courts have made a distinction on, and that was from this case and that case is that we're talking about a marital relationship. We're talking about a marital child. The child was an issue of marriage. In AEH, we're not talking about that same kind of relationship. That child was not a marital child. That child was born out of wedlock and obviously necessitated the paternity action. And I know that there have been other states that have said that, specifically, I think North Carolina has taken a position in some, and I think other states that the status exemption would apply in when you sought to terminate the parental rights of an unadjudicated father or someone that doesn't legitimize that parent-child relationship. I think that's a significant difference.
Also, the thing that is perplexing about this case is, of course, Arizona has turned down jurisdiction. You're here saying we don't have jurisdiction. The amicus says, well, maybe they say basically, well, you know, that the child is caught in the middle. And so if the court doesn't act, where do you think jurisdiction should be or is?
Well, I think the court has to take a look at the turn down of jurisdiction by the court in Arizona with some suspicion. It was an ex parte referral of an order. The parties were not all present when that occurred, and there was no notice that that was being sought at the time.
So you think we should, assuming we adopt your position, we would just, or we say, all right, we want Arizona to take jurisdiction? Is that what?
I think there's a basis to be made that Arizona has jurisdiction. They made, after all, the state of Arizona did make, in fact, make an initial custody determination in this case. That court was the initial court to establish the mother as the custodian of this child. So I think that if presented with it, where the position of the father could actually be heard, I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that Arizona does, in fact, having decided the custody issue of this child in the past, that this was a product of a marriage in Arizona, that this was in fact a product of a relationship between the father and child in Arizona. I mean, part of the problem is that there was never any kind of relationship between the father and this child in the state of Wisconsin. The only state where that relationship actually existed was the state of Arizona.
But wouldn't the jurisdiction in the Arizona court require the presence of the child and residence of the child in Arizona? So the mother would have to move in order to accomplish this TPR under the Arizona jurisdiction?
I'm glad that you mentioned the burden on mother, because part of the difficulty that I certainly have with this case is that the mother was, at the time of the divorce,
appoint the time of the marriage was a resident of the state of Arizona. After filing the divorce, she moved to Nebraska. Within a very short period of time, she moved within Nebraska without providing any notice to either the Arizona court or to my client. Then later, she moved again. She actually moved to the state of Wisconsin from the state of Nebraska without giving any notice to my client or to the court that had jurisdiction over the child, moved without giving any notice at all. In fact, the only time that my client was able to determine the whereabouts of his child was when he was served with a petition for termination of parental rights. Up to that point, he did not know where his son was at.
I asked a question about whether the mother would have to move to Arizona in order for there to be jurisdiction in Arizona and take the child with her, establish residency, etc.
I think she would need to submit herself to the jurisdiction of the state of Arizona.
By consent? By consent?
Well, I think she can do that. She's already under the jurisdiction of the Arizona court through divorce action and through the custody order that they have.
Would she have to establish residency there with the child in order for Arizona to have jurisdiction over this action?
Well, I don't know that she would necessarily have to establish residency. I think that given the fact that there is a previous court order, that there's a previous custody order, and that she in fact moved from the state of Arizona in the process of this, I don't think that there's necessarily a requirement that she be a resident of Arizona, as long as my client is a resident of Arizona.
What about the child's presence? So your argument is that she and the child can stay here and litigate the case in Arizona, and Arizona would have jurisdiction.
Well, I don't think that they need to establish residence in Arizona for this to be heard in Arizona. And I think that, in fact, if you looked at the Parental Prevention Kidnapping Act, The fact that there was a previous custody order that was put in place by the state of Arizona, in fact, by federal law, it preempts this state or any other state from claiming or establishing any modification of that custody order as long as my client remains in the state of Arizona. And I think so. I think because of those factors, I think that serves to bring the whole matter back to the state of Arizona and really causes the state of Arizona to have a substantial interest in this because they had the initial interest in it at the onset.
Well, I mean, the same could be true with your client both coming to Wisconsin, if possible, and asserting his right here. It's whose interest are you going to consideration? But right now, my initial question was, well, we have a person in limbo, and your suggestion is that, I hear you correctly, answering Justice Sykes, that she does not have to move, the child doesn't have to move, and I find that interesting, but if we adopt a position favorable to you, then there wouldn't be, this is still left in limbo because Arizona has denied jurisdiction. And I can't realistically see where it would assume jurisdiction unless the mother was there and filed probably the child.
That's argument that the amicus makes also, that this court should do something based upon the facts of this particular case.
Well, I think there's another significant issue that is perhaps peculiar to this case, because if you look at the sole ground that they were able to establish as a basis for termination of parental rights, it was a ground that's fairly unique to Wisconsin, and that is that there be a custody order in place that prohibits contact or visitation for a year or longer. I have to remember that when that divorce was entered back in 1993, in the state of Arizona, that's not a basis for termination of parental rights. By forcing him to come to the state of Wisconsin, you're essentially saying that you have to have known back in 93 or thereafter that you would have been subjected to the laws and the jurisdiction of this state, anticipating that the mother was actually going to move to the state of Wisconsin and be able to establish some kind of basis for termination of parental rights. And it's also worth noting that in the state of Wisconsin, under the due process requirements, under the family code, if this would have occurred in the state of Wisconsin, my client would have been told, he would have been warned by the court, that if this order stays in place for a year or longer, you can be subject to termination of parental rights. He was not afforded that in Arizona, because that's not part of the Arizona statutory scheme.
Counsel, like the Utah case, a lot of cases that we see in the court system for termination of parental rights do not involve a mother moving for the termination of the other parent, or a father moving, but rather county social services. In fact, that happens a lot. The county, so you've got a kid or a child that has been in need of protection services, has had out-of-home placement for a substantial period of time, and it's the county that moves for termination of both parental rights. That's happens often in termination cases. So I just want to play out this argument that the amicus makes. The amicus says, hey, you're leaving the child in limbo. There's no, under your interpretation, no state will exercise jurisdiction. The child can never be adopted, never be have a family. Discussion was made about, well, the mother could move or the mother could do something. What about county social services? Under your interpretation, social services wants to terminate the parental rights, are they going to then, is the county of Lafayette going to have to take a social worker and the child out of the foster home and go to Arizona? How's that going to work?
Well, I think certainly one of the issues that I struggle with, too, in looking at this case, I think that there is probably under, and I guess what I looked at was under 769, which is the one of the, I think I referenced it in my brief, that there were
some delineation of circumstances where a parent would have availed himself to the services of the county. And I think if I understand the Utah case correctly, one of the arguments that is made in that case, because that one of the distinctions between this case and the Utah case is that is in fact a state moving for termination of parental rights, that there was an act by the parent who
I wasn't clear in my question. Doesn't your interpretation require that the Department of Social Services would, in a moving for termination of parental rights, would have to take the child out of the current placement, foster home or residential care or wherever the current placement is, and take the child with a social worker and spend some time in Arizona filing a termination of parental rights? Isn't that what's required under your interpretation?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, then tell me how that would...
Because
if Arizona law requires, as the judge's order says, for the court to have personal jurisdiction over the case, the child who is the subject of the termination must be present in the state of Arizona, citing ARS section 8532.
I think that in that case, I think that the case can be made that minimum contacts with the state of Wisconsin by the parent that has essentially either abandoned or has not either abandoned or neglected his parental responsibility by allowing the child to continue in the state of Wisconsin, that parent is effectively saying that here, state, you take care of the child. I think one of the things that has to remember under Chapter 48, one of the obligations when you start a CHIPS action is that the social service agency is to look to the availability of another parent or a relative. I would expect that a social worker or the county would have already looked at a parent as a possible placement for that child under
CHIPS. Does your interpretation then indicate that if the county moves for termination of parental rights, then the father, like here, who has been to Wisconsin, will be deemed subject to Wisconsin jurisdiction, but if the mother moves for termination of parental rights, the same father with the same lack of contact will be determined not to be subject to Wisconsin jurisdiction? So it depends on who moves. Is that your interpretation?
I don't think it's necessarily a question of who moves, because under a termination of parental rights case that started or that was initiated as a dependency case, the mother could move for termination herself. What I think is significant is that under a case that arose out of a CHIPS or a dependency action, you would have a parent that would have knowingly or not knowingly at least availed himself to the services of the state of Wisconsin by allowing the state of Wisconsin to care for and provide for and place into foster care his child. And consequently, in that way, he has availed himself to the services of this state, and consequently, there are minimum contacts in that kind of a situation. In this situation, we have no contacts. He didn't even know he was here. How could he possibly have had any kind of contacts with the state? I think that is where the distinction lies.
Mr. Jorgensen, let's focus on your client, if we might, for a minute.
Sure.
Under the UCCJA, is your client not given adequate opportunity to present his side of the case, even if he doesn't come to Wisconsin? Aren't there devices available to him to present his side fairly without even coming to the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I don't think it's just a question of geography. Because, again, it's certainly he was afforded court-appointed counsel to represent him, and he was afforded the opportunity to participate in the proceeding by telephone.
He's got notice, he's got opportunity to be involved in the case. What more is needed, in your opinion?
Well, the inherent difficulty is that he's being asked to be subject to an entirely different set of laws and social policies regarding termination of parental rights without having availed himself to the services of this state. The state of Arizona has one set of policies, and frankly, if this matter were brought in the state of Arizona, termination could not be sustained because the grounds that are being asserted here aren't grounds in the state of Arizona. And so, I mean, there's a basic fundamental unfairness to subject someone who the basis is a custody order by the state of Arizona that says he can't have visitation with his son, and then to use that without availing himself to the same, to take that order, take that to Wisconsin that has a different social policy, and say, okay, we're going to take that 93 order that says you can't have visitation, and we're going to use it to terminate your parental rights. Where in Wisconsin, if he would have received that result in the court, he would have been told, either orally, in writing, or both, that it can be used to terminate your parental rights. He has no basis, he has no warning, he has no basis to know that this is something that can be used to terminate his parental rights here in this state. And how can you, fundamentally, how can you haul someone in to court, hail him in from the state of Arizona, he has no contacts, and say, you've got to live by our social policy, even though what you did is something that you did in Arizona.
In your view, how would the state gain personal jurisdiction if, as was alluded to, the father simply disappeared?
Well, I think there, there may be some difficulty with that, depending upon what the what the circumstances are.
Take the same circumstances, except that you're not able to communicate directly with the father, and he's just gone. Exactly the same case, but the father cannot be located. You can only use publication service if you've got a basis for personal service. If you don't have, you're right that there's no basis for personal service, you can't do anything about it.
Well, I think that under the state of Wisconsin law, particularly, I don't, thinking in terms of the best analogy I can come up with is I think it, divorce action, where the state is taking the position that in a case where someone comes in and petitions the court that for a divorce and the other things that go with it, whether it be custody, property division, or whatever, that if the person that is seeking to be brought in does not object, that the court can then take jurisdiction over that parent, or in that case, a spouse, and they can make those determinations. What you have here is you have someone that's saying, "No, wait a minute. You do not have personal jurisdiction over me. I object to this. I object to this because of all the things that I have basically argued that it's not fundamentally unfair to bring me in here."
How can you object if you don't have notice?
Well, I think that we in civil practice we deal with people that cannot be found on a regular basis, and we have created notice requirements that involve publication and attempting to find and serve them at very least at their last known address, and making publication in local newspapers where they resided. And that has, it's pretty clear that over the course of time that is historically, that has been deemed sufficient notice. If you establish that you made a good faith effort to try to serve the person, you cannot serve them, and then publish in a local newspaper that is designed to reasonably give that person notice, then he is deemed to have received that notice. In essence, and I see that I am running out of time, but I think it's one of the things that I have not touched on, and that is there's been a lot of discussion regarding the different varying cases, and I think it's imperative that it not, that the distinction between subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction in the cases not be blurred. I think there has been sort of a blurring that in some cases the issue of subject matter jurisdiction was the focus of the action, and there was no issue about personal jurisdiction. I think it needs to be, in reviewing the case law, you need to pay particular attention to what was really contested and whether or not personal jurisdiction was really put at issue. In many of those cases, that has not necessarily been something that jumps right out. Also, there is the distinction between custody cases. Custody case is not a custody case. It's not a custody case. There are different rights and due process considerations that need to be taken into consideration when dealing with custody issues. As the guardian ad litem alluded to, a divorce has a whole different set of due process rights that are available as opposed to in a termination proceeding. We're talking about terminating a right that is personal to the parent. That is a basic fundamental right of the parent, a right that by nature comes from the parent. as personal to him and personal to the parent. And in there lies why, in our view, there needs to be personal jurisdiction, because this is not merely a status. This is not merely impacting on that relationship. This is termination. This is the severing of that relationship forever and ever. Amen. There will be no relationship. And I struggle to find definition for what status is, and one of the things in the restatements that it indicates is that the status is merely the legal recognition of a pre-existing legal circumstance, and that it cannot not be used to terminate or end, commence or end that relationship. Thank you, Mr. Jorgensen. Mr. Bestel?
Thank you. There are just a handful of points I want to hit on rebuttal, and I guess the one thing I want to emphasize is that we are not making new law here. I'm a little chagrined that the Utah Attorney General worked the AEH case much more than I did and argued it much more effectively than I did. But the AEH case makes it clear that although a context analysis is normally performed in the context of personal jurisdiction, that's not required in the UCCJA status adjudication. And in AEH, the court wrote, for the status adjudication of custody, the UCCJA encourages maximum contacts with the state where the custody determination must be made. And it refers specifically then to the Schaefer versus Heitner footnote, acknowledging the existence of the status determination. And in AEH, they concluded that the invocation of status under the UCCJA did not violate or offend traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice, even with a father who never had any contacts with the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Jorgensen has made a distinction between that case and the case involving a marital child, but there again, Wisconsin has addressed that issue. In Thompson versus Thompson, the 1986 case, you have a Minnesota divorce initially, and then the children are brought to Wisconsin. There's no indication in that case that the father ever came into the state of Wisconsin, and yet Wisconsin trial court and appellate court both held that it was appropriate for Wisconsin to make a custody adjudication, a determination regarding custody rights of the children, but the courts in that case specifically found that the personal obligation of child support could not be determined concerning the father in Minnesota because he didn't have the contacts, and they sent that personal obligation back to Minnesota. So they used the UCCJA to accomplish custody jurisdiction here that bound the Minnesota father. But
Mr. Bestel, how would you define status or status determination? We heard Mr. Jorgensen's definition. What's your definition?
Status, in this case, I believe, is a relationship between individuals that has that's recognized by the law, that in particular may have import beyond the immediate individuals, and the state may have an interest in it, and it's not terminable at will. If it is to be terminated, there must be some legal proceedings to terminate it. Hence, a marriage is a status for purposes of status adjudication. Likewise, a parental relationship is a status relationship. And I think the argument for invoking personal jurisdiction under the status doctrine is much stronger indeed in a case involving a child than it is in a marriage. There's no question it applies to the marriage. But a marriage is a voluntary status that's created. and it's recognized by law after it's voluntarily created, but the state has an interest in terminating it. The child has no say in the relationship he or she has with an unfit parent. And for that reason, a state's interest in protecting the child by adjudicating her status is, if anything, greater than the state's interest in adjudicating the marital status. Wisconsin hit.
Are you finished with that answer?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me what happened? The termination of parental rights was filed in Lafayette County. The respondent asked for the matter to be dismissed. What are the circumstances of how the case then came before the court in Arizona? I know that the mother filed a motion to decline visitation, but where was the father in all of that?
I don't know the specifics of that, but I believe the mother retained an attorney in Arizona to specifically file a request to determine whether Arizona would or could assert jurisdiction.
It's my understanding that the circuit, tell me if my understanding is correct, it's my understanding that the circuit court suspended its proceedings, or after denying the motion to dismiss that was advanced by the father, gave the parties an opportunity to go to Arizona to have the jurisdiction issue clarified or addressed.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Actually, Judge Welker asked that that be done after the disposition hearing, but specifically gave either party 30 days to ask the Arizona court to either assert or decline jurisdiction. And that's where the order resulted. But as far as the specifics of notice to the father, I don't know about that, but that was the timing of that, yes. I see my time is up, so thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you both, Mr. Bestel and Mr. Jorgensen, for your appearance today and your arguments. That terminates the hearing in 0.